This is the Mideast Madness show for June 24th, 2013. If you're listening live, you may call in to the following phone numbers at any point in the program, regardless of your status, gender, ethnicity, religion, sexual preference, whether you're related to me or not, whether you know me personally or not. Call in at area code 831-427-3772. Again, that's 831-427-3772. Or call me at line 2, 469-3119. 469-3119. And this is the Mideast Madness Show with your host, Ren Tawil. First piece of news is a reminder to everyone. The weekend version of Mideast Madness Show is now on the air. It started its maiden voyage last Saturday, 11 p.m. 11 a.m., 11 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon every Saturday. And we shall continue with the Monday version, starting at 3 p.m. every Monday on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Those are the two slots, time slots, on the Free Radio schedule for Mideast Madness when I will be here. God willing, as it were. Okay. From the ADC, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, over three decades of advocacy and achievements. Let's see, this came across to me June the 12th. It is with great sadness that ADC mourns the death of Sammy O'Day, who passed away on June 6th, 2013, after suffering from a long illness. The ADC team would like to offer our deepest condolences to the O'Day family, particularly his wife Lisa and each person Sammy loved and influenced during his lifetime. A dedicated Palestinian and Arab American activist, Sammy worked tirelessly to achieve justice for his brother Alex O'Day. Alex, 41 years old at the time, was assassinated in October of 1985, 28 years ago, at the ADC OC chapter headquarters. ADC President Warren David sent a condolence letter to Lisa O'Day this week, writing that ADC is and will continue to be committed to justice for all Arab Americans. Warren also promised to continue to work to fulfill Sammy's desire to see justice served for his brother's assassination. We regret that Sammy O'Day never lived to see justice served for Alex's death, but are hopeful that this case will be solved soon. After some 28 years. Last week, after being contacted by ADC, Congresswoman Sanchez sent this letter to the Attorney General and FBI requesting, requesting an update on Alex O'Day's murder. And ADC asks you to contact your elected official and urge them to request an update from the Attorney General. Here, let's go to the text of the letter to Congresswoman Sanchez. Loading. And for those who may or may not recall the name O'Day or Alex O'Day, he was indeed killed in 1985. As the note of condolence just said, in an ADC office in Los Angeles, I believe. He was the victim of a bomb that was set in the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee office there. Okay, Congress of the United States House of Representatives, June 7th, 2013. Eric Holder. It's funny, the previous dispatch said they sent this to Congresswoman Sanchez. Yeah, Loretta Sanchez, 46th District of California. And then on to Eric Holder, Attorney General of the United States, Washington, D.C. Dear Attorney General Holder. Holder, that's his name. Close to 28 years have passed since the death of Alex O'Day, an anti-discrimination activist killed in a bombing in Santa Ana, California, just outside the city of Los Angeles, which I represent in Congress. Okay, this is Loretta Sanchez speaking. The letter is to Eric Holder from Congressman Sanchez. Close to 28 years have passed since the death of Alex O'Day, an anti-discrimination activist killed in a bombing in Santa Ana, California, which I represent in Congress on April 11, 1985. Mr. O'Day, who served as the Western Regional Director of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, was opening the doors of his office when a pipe bomb exploded, killing him and injuring several others. To this day, no arrests have been made, and no one has been held accountable for the attack. The FBI's case into Alex O'Day's murder remains open and is classified as a, quote, priority investigation. Given the priority status of this case, I am requesting an update on this open case, as I believe the O'Day family deserves closure. Thank you for your consideration to our request, and I look forward to hearing back from you. Sincerely, Loretta Sanchez, Member of Congress. Carbon copy sent to Robert Mueller, Director of the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI. Printed on recycled paper. Okay. I decided to open the show with this piece, as it is already almost 2 weeks old. I take it for granted whether or not I read this note of condolence from the ADC people would just, it wouldn't have any effect on any current listeners to this show or a repeat of this show. Most people indeed have never heard of Alex O'Day. But I remember when we first got word of this assassination, successful assassination of at least one person, and the word at the time was, clearly this is a case where someone deliberately was targeting Arab Americans, perhaps Palestinian Americans, as Alex O'Day was. And they cleanly got away with this. A bombing, a pipe bombing. Doesn't sound like that was sent in the mail. They didn't say letter bomb. They said pipe bomb. So someone most likely had broken into the place or subsequently got in there while it was open and managed to place the pipe bomb. Who knows? And still the FBI has no leads, as they say, or any leads they had didn't pan out. So I open this episode of Mideast Madness with a note that anyone is vulnerable in talking about the debacle between Israelis and Palestinians, Israelis and the various Arab nations. not only Jews suffer here in the United States and around the world, but indeed Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims are being targeted. That's not to take attention away from any specific religious or ethnic group. The point is, I don't mind telling people that we're all vulnerable, we're all at risk, and through my eyes, the Muslims, at least in this country, U.S. of A., are suffering far, far more, and are targeted far more, and stressed far, far more than any Israeli Americans who may be living in the U.S. or located here, and any other American Jews, any Jews in the U.S. We have heard incessantly, I'm sure no one can argue with this. If you care to argue, call those numbers I gave her earlier, and I will repeat the phone numbers. No one will question the fact that we are constantly reminded, one way or another, either of the terrible persecution the Jews have had to deal with over the centuries as a small minority compared to the Christian and the Muslim worlds. I'm not denying that this suffering has taken place. I'm simply pointing out that we are reminded and reminded, one way or another, as pointed out to us, either of the general longstanding persecution of Jews and of the Jewish faith, or the most horrendous recent example, recent in the long history of things, the Holocaust, which occurred during the Second World War, perpetrated primarily by the Nazis of Nazi Germany, 1933 to 1945. Professor Norman Finkelstein has written a book addressing the peculiar and blatant character of what he calls the Holocaust industry, which is dedicated and has been fervently successful in pushing and pushing and pushing their agenda of never letting the world forget about the Holocaust. That's all fine and well. But while they're doing this, Israel continues to commit its own human rights violations against the indigenous Arab people of Palestine. So, I think I've beaten that one to death. Let's move along. Speaking of which, the persecution and humiliation of the Palestinian people. Here's a piece that I read last Saturday on the maiden airing of weekend edition of Mideast Madness from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, one of their narratives. And this is called "Whatever You Take from the Sea Takes Back from You." Majid Fadl Hassan Baker, 53, is a fisherman from the Gaza Strip. Having been a fisherman since the age of 10, he has borne witness to the sharp decline of the fishing industry in the Gaza Strip in recent years. Majid's weathered skin shows evidence of a life outdoors. Life as a fisherman in the Gaza Strip is one of the most dangerous seafaring jobs in the world. This is not due to adverse weather conditions or because their catch resides at unreachable depths. The greatest danger for fishermen from Gaza is posed by Israeli gunboats. This is the IDF we're talking about, the Israeli Navy. Continuing. The closure of the Gaza Strip has been in effect since the early 1990s, though it has seen a sharp increase since 2007. While trying to provide for their families in the face of great economic turmoil resulting from the Israeli-imposed closure, they are often attacked and harassed through random acts of violence and acts of vandalism against their boats. Imprisonment is also a concern, even when sailing well within the fishing limits. The Israeli soldiers have a history of destroying fishermen's boats and, in turn, their livelihood, affecting not only the fishermen, but also their families, who often depend on them as their sole source of income. And for those of you who are simply saying to themselves or talking back at the radio or computer, well, that's just what he says. Why should I believe it? Well, for one thing, this dispatch, again, comes from PCHR, Palestinian Center for Human Rights, headquartered in Palestine. And there are many other sources that, if you trust the Israelis, you can go to B'Tselem, the leading Israeli human rights group, and read what they have to say about it. And various other groups in America here will concur with this. I will concur with it because I, Ren, have been to the Gaza Strip. So I, for one, on a deeply personal level, know this is true. Continuing with the dispatch. After the 2012 November offensive, codenamed Operation Pillar of Defense, one of the terms of the Egyptian-brokered ceasefire was the extension of the fishing limit from 3 to 6 nautical miles. However, in March 2013, Israel again reduced the fishing area to 3 nautical miles. Regardless of where the boundary is set, Israel continues their attacks on fishing boats deemed to be too close to the limit. They fire if you come close to the limit, explains Majed. Sometimes even fishing boats that are clearly within the nautical mile limit are attacked. Already constrained by the fluctuating limit, fishermen also face the threat of injury or death as they attempt to make a living. Majed lost his boat in October 2012 when he set sail to try his luck at catching some fish. Majid says, it is hard to find good fish within the limit. Fish only come this close to land when it is time to lay their eggs. Before the closure, when the limit was around 12 miles, we could catch 30 to 50 kilos of fish every day. Now I cannot catch enough to cover the cost of fuel for the generator and maintenance for the solar panels. Most of my equipment was designed for deep sea fishing. It is useless at 3 miles. Majed continues, in October, I was sailing with two of my sons within the limit. We were attacked without warning by two Israeli gunboats. They fired at the generator and destroyed it, and then warned us that we were past the limit. End quote. Majed pointed out that they had been within the limit and, moreover, that the Israeli forces had fired upon them before issuing any warning. The aggression against Majed and his crew did not end after the engine was destroyed. He says, the soldiers then made us strip and swim to their gunboat. They bound our hands and feet, blindfolded us, and tied us to the boat. The crew was taken to Israel on the Israeli gunboat, and their fishing boat was towed behind. After a number of hours of detention, the crew was released at Beit Hanun, or as the Israelis call it, Erez, border crossing. where they crossed back into the Gaza Strip. Now they want me to pay in transportation costs for them to bring my boat back to Gaza. I am already $5,000 in debt for the engine and solar panels. Many fishermen in Gaza have installed solar panels, which charge during the day so that they may illuminate the sea at night in the hope of attracting fish. If I don't pay for my boat to be returned, I will have to buy another one. I don't have any money. How can I pay? I refuse to pay. They are the ones who did the damage. They are the ones who fired without warning and took my boat. Why should I pay for what they did? They have no right to ask for money. It would cost the same to buy a new boat as it would to transport his old boat home and repair its engine. However, Majid cannot afford either option. He says, there is a saying in Gaza, whatever you take from the sea takes back from you. Now, the only way I can make money is if a friend allows me to go with him on his boat to fish, but because there are few fish within the limit, it is not enough. I have 14 people in my family who all look to me to provide for them. How can I? Incidentally, I will add, chances are that he's not simply referring to himself and his wife and 12 children. He's probably including other generations, perhaps his parents and grandchildren. Continuing with the narrative. Since April 2012 until February of 2013, Palestinian Center for Human Rights has documented 7 cases whereby the Israeli officials have attempted to charge Palestinian fishermen for transportation costs for them to get their boats back. On the 8th of October, one day after the incident, the PCHR launched several complaints in regard to this form of extortion, demanding a serious investigation and the returning of their boat. PCHR then received a response saying that an investigation is underway by Israeli officials. On the 23rd of May 2013, PCHR received a response from the Israeli prosecution stating that they are ready to hand over the 7 boats, including the one mentioned in the narrative. The conditions for this handover dictate that the owner of the boat must sign a contract that they will not exceed the fishing limits. They also state that the transportation is undertaken by a third-party loading company, so the fishermen are responsible for the costs. The boats will also be returned as they were captured, minus the engines, as they exceed the Israeli-imposed limitation of a 25-horsepower engine, so are therefore deemed illegal. Currently, the owners of all the boats have refused these conditions, as the transportation and cost of a new engine is generally more expensive than buying a new boat altogether. When asked how he felt after the incident, Majid seemed frail as his eyes began to well. I am depressed. Fishing is my life. I know nothing else. I have no education and no other skills. I have been fishing since I was 10 years old. Now I live in poverty as I cannot find other work. If the closure carries on and the Israelis keep acting so aggressively, there is no future for me or the entire fishing industry in Gaza. I want to ask Israel, why Palestine? We want our freedom and dignity back. Why are you stopping us from doing what we love? Majid explains the poverty trap that fishermen are in, which in turn results in a bleak outlook for the younger generations. He says, there are not enough fish, so we must take our children out of school to help us fish, as we cannot afford to pay for workers. This means they get no education, which means that they cannot get a good job when they are older. Israel's attacks against Palestinian fishermen in the Gaza Strip, who do not pose any threat to the security of the Israeli naval forces, constitute a flagrant violation of international humanitarian and human rights. The fishing exclusion zone maintained through arbitrary arrests and attacks constitutes a measure of collective punishment, which is prohibited under Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. The right to work, including in just and favorable conditions, is provided for under Article 23 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, as well as under Articles 6 and 7 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, ICESCR. Moreover, Article 11 of the ICESCR recognizes, and I quote, the right of everyone to an adequate standard of living for himself and his family, including adequate food, clothing and housing, and to the continuous improvement of living conditions. Again, this from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, which has an office in Gaza City on the Gaza Strip. And that would be their main office, if not their only one. As I was saying on Saturday when I read this piece, sounds pretty horrendous, doesn't it? Whether you believe it or not, we are hearing, I am reading to you, renditions of totally unforgivable and quite horrendous actions taken by the Israeli government, by the Israeli military, against unarmed civilians who are not Jews. They are not citizens of Israel proper, even though Israel has restrictions on the size of motors they can use on their boats, etc. Why on earth would Israel do such terrible things, you may be asking? You may believe that this is all one big long lie. And so often have I heard the defenders of Israel declare that the Arabs lie, the Palestinians lie, and they try to tell the world what is going on. And we're supposed to believe the Israelis outright, right? As I was saying last Saturday after reading this piece, there must be, if what I read to you is true, Israel must have an agenda, which goes far beyond simply knocking out of existence, or at least out of their local economy, individual Palestinians. It's clear that they are deliberately making life impossible for the average Joe or the average Mo. Don't take that the wrong way. I'm trying to be clever here. Just forget that part. And essentially doing the same thing to the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip that they've been doing to the Palestinians in the West Bank. They're fighting. They are declaring a kind of bullying war over the Palestinian Arabs there, both places, West Bank and Gaza, always under the guise of defending the Israeli state and preventing terrorism and capturing or killing or otherwise suppressing the terrorists. Even though, certainly over the past few years, all of these terrible actions have taken place outside of Israel proper, in the occupied territories where the Palestinians have no real rights, certainly none, or very few of them, as they would transpire to the Israeli courts. The IDF, the Israeli so-called defense forces, do this in an attempt to either drive away the Palestinians, force them outside the boundaries of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, from there perhaps into Egypt, They're already refusing. Israel is already severely restricting travel into or from the Gaza Strip. And in many cases, if not most, Gazans who manage to make it outside of the Gaza Strip, going to someplace besides Israel, are not allowed to return. Israelis would love to see the Palestinians just go away. So it's either that, make them go away, or simply browbeat them into submission and making them too afraid to resist. The profile of the average Palestinian and what Palestinian nationalism is really about has been raised in recent years. And this makes the Israelis very angry. They don't want the world to see the Palestinians as a real people. They deny their very existence, saying there's no such thing as a Palestinian. And as I continue with my personal commentary and my opinions, which I believe are well-founded, Israel, I think, would love to go back into the Gaza Strip. Ultimately, there have been some articles about this speculation. Drive them into Egypt or elsewhere and create a kind of Eastern Riviera. Resorts, hotels, accommodations for tourists, swimming pools. Right now, the ocean off the Gaza Strip is, and has been for some years now, poisoned because of the effluent, the pollution that comes out of the human population of the Gaza Strip, which cannot be stopped or arrested because the Gazans can no longer treat their spoiled sewage and certain industrial substances because they cannot get replacement parts for the machinery of the treatment plants. Or they cannot power them, or they are intermittently powered from their electric grid, which depends, of course, on Israel. Again, this is all a deliberate attempt on the part of Israel. And again, I have been to the Gaza Strip. I have seen it up close, and I have learned about this on the ground there. Once Israel moves back into the Gaza Strip, they may re-erect their settlements and start cleaning up the water and the land for their purposes. Why else might the Israelis do this? Because there is a substantial undersea field of natural gas under the ground, under the sea, and it lies within Gazan territorial waters. That is to say, internationally, maritime recognized Gazan territorial waters. Israel is in the process of harvesting this natural gas, as they are from some other smaller fields in Israeli territorial waters, and I think also from gas fields under the sea in international waters. They're doing this through special arrangement and huckstering activities with various commercial interests that through which they're extracting this natural gas, and through some dirty politics are preventing the Palestinians from taking advantage of their natural resource, which could indeed, which has the potential, it is still there, the potential for turning Gaza Strip, if not into its own Eastern Riviera, if not a paradise on earth, at least the Palestinian people could make a decent living there and thrive on their own land. That would clearly explain why Israel commits these super blatant forms of harassment. Again, the phone numbers to talk to me live on this Monday, June 24th, 2013, live episode of Mideast Madness. Phone numbers are area code 831-427-3772. And the second line to the studio is 469-3119. Let's hear from you. I would love to talk to people instead of just hanging out here and listening to the sound of my own voice. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. Which, by the way, as I'm sure you can imagine, or if you don't know by now, is highly dependent on public support. Our own bylaws prohibit us from taking in corporate money or other monies from commercial interests, just as we cannot advertise for profit-making commercial interests. But we'll take your money. I pay money to do this show. Free Radio Santa Cruz does not pay me or any of its programmers. We put in to this service for the privilege of doing our respective shows. The rest must come from you. Please, please consider sending your donations to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Just write down FRSC, P.O. Box 7811. Santa Cruz, California, 95061. And Santa Cruz, of course, is two words, S-A-N-T-A-C-R-U-Z, Santa Cruz, en Español, California, 95061. I can hear, well, earlier, I was able to hear that our antenna, we are getting some output from our current antenna site, which, very sadly, is due to fall out of commission in about 2 weeks or less, because the land that our that Free Radio's antenna sets upon is being foreclosed upon. I've just very recently gotten to know, on a personal level, the owner of the land, which, of course, she is losing since it's being foreclosed upon. And what a super individual she is. She, well, sometime after the last day of June, before too long, the electricity will run out. And even if the antenna continues to sit there for any number of days, it will lack power. And we will only be an internet service, if that. So, call the studio if you have any ideas or offers. Any creative thoughts about where and how we shall re-erect the transmitter and continue providing the Santa Cruz County and the world, indeed, through streaming internet with this radio service. Ah, I know what I'll do. Engage in a lovely beverage here. Diet Cola. So, my name is Ren Tawil. Call me here at the studio at those numbers. So much to read, so little time, and yet so very, very few people ever hear my voice. I take that for granted because, quite frankly, that's par for the course for Free Radio throughout America is we simply don't have. We may have the technical reach to get the message out to people's ears, but we don't have advertisement like we should have. We simply don't have a budget for it. Free radio, of course, is an ongoing expression of civil disobedience as we continue to be unregulated by federal authorities. So we believe in what we're doing in earnest. Why did I say that? I forget why exactly. Okay, here's a... I think this is an important piece that everyone, Jew or non-Jew, should hear. Written by Roger Cohen in the New York Times. Published June 20th. It's called Why American Jews Matter. And yes, the author, Roger Cohen, is Jewish. Roger Cohen is an op-ed columnist. June 20, Why American Jews Matter. London. New ideas are scarce on Israel-Palestine. But Secretary of State John Kerry may have the semblance of one if major American Jewish organizations are among Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's most important constituencies. Perhaps those same groups can exert leverage over Israeli policy towards the Palestinians. It is a long shot. These organizations have shown deep reluctance to criticize Israel. But then along came Kerry's trump card in the form of Naftali Bennett, the Israeli economy minister. This nationalist neophyte has performed a public service by clarifying the objective inherent in Israeli settlement expansion in the West Bank. Quote, "The attempt to establish a Palestinian state in our land has ended," he said this week. Again, the quotation from the Israeli economy minister is, "The attempt to establish a Palestinian state in our land has ended." And he refers to our land. He's talking about Eretz Israel, which is Hebrew for the land of Israel, as the Israelis see it. It includes all of historic Palestine, all of the political mandate of British Palestine, and in the eyes of most Jews in Israel, includes land in other current Arab nations. So when they say a Palestinian state in our land, they're simply dismissing wholesale the notion of a sovereign, independent, and secure Palestinian state anywhere near Israel, which in effect means anywhere. Continuing now with this New York Times opinion editorial. Speaking at a settlers conference, Bennett urged Israel to, quote, "build, build, build," in order to establish an, and I quote, "Israeli presence everywhere." Bennett called for the rapid annexation of more than 60% of the West Bank, declared that the land had been Israel's for 3,000 years, and characterized the quest for a two-state solution as a colossal exercise in futility. In short, two states? Forget about it. Forget about it. That's Roger Cohen talking. His comments followed equally dismissive remarks early this month from Danny Danon, the deputy defense minister. He said most Israelis had, quote, "given up the idea of land for peace," and urged Israel to annex wide swaths of the West Bank. Bennett and Dannon were being explicit about an aim implicit in Israeli actions, as opposed to words, since the lightning victory in the 1967 war delivered all the land between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River to the Israelis and ignited a strong vein of Israeli religious nationalism. The, quote, miracle of annexation of East Jerusalem and control of the West Bank was proof of a mission to hold all of Eretz Israel, the biblical land of Israel, to which Bennett referred. Incidentally, at the age of 41, Bennett has never lived in an Israel that did not exercise humiliating domination over West Bank Palestinians. And this messianic view of the Jewish state's destiny has grown for the past 46 years, since 67, despite undertakings from various leaders, including Netanyahu in 2009, to seek a two-state peace. If the number of Israeli settlers in the West Bank, outside East Jerusalem, has doubled in the past dozen years to over 350,000, Bennett put the number at 400,000. It is because the notion that all the land belongs to Israel by divine decree has been ascendant and compromise increasingly seen as a deficit of faith. Construction has spelled out what official government policy could not quite say. We have no plans to leave. In other words, the expansion of Jewish settlements in Arab Palestine is a kind of, it has a certain under-the-table quality about it. The government generally does not come right out and say, hey, this is really part of Israel, despite our disagreements following the war in 1967. We don't really mean it. The Palestinians have no real rights there anyway. And this is for the best interest of all Jews and Jews only. Continuing with the op-ed. It is in this sense that Bennett's statement is a true public service. Far better to have clarity about the meaning of Israel's actions in the West Bank than to have a fait accompli, the growing settler presence, cloaked in governmental opacity about the ultimate objective. If the aim is known, then a judgment can be made, not least by American Jewish organizations. Kerry, in a speech this month to the American Jewish Committee, AJC, laid out what holding all the land means. Quote, Israel will be left to choose between being a Jewish state or a democratic state. This is Kerry talking now. John Kerry, American Secretary of State. Israel will be left to choose between being a Jewish state or a democratic state, but it will not be able to fulfill the founders' visions of being both, end quote. Well, it's about time that an American in a truly responsible position of power came out and said so in so many words. That is an astounding statement coming from a sitting American Secretary of State. And again, it is about time. It should be shouted to the rooftops in every town of Israel. Israel will be left to choose between being a Jewish state or a democratic state, but it will not be able to fulfill the Zionist founders' visions of being both. A very critical point. Continuing with op-ed. That is no less true for being a tired refrain. Then, after evoking a menacing future in the absence of peace, he made this pitch. No one has a stronger voice in this than the American Jewish community. Remember now, Kerry is speaking to the American Jewish Committee. He says, no one has a stronger voice in this than the American Jewish community. You can play a critical part in ensuring Israel's long-term security. And as President Obama said in Jerusalem, leaders will take bold steps only if their people push them. End quote. I'm very impressed. This is a truly monumental quotation from John Kerry. Continuing with op-ed, the AJC executive director, David Harris, decided to push with a punchy denunciation of Bennett. The minister's remarks, he said, were stunningly short-sighted, quote-unquote, must be, quote, repudiated by the country's top leaders and offer, quote, only the prospect of a dead-end strategy of endless conflict and growing isolation for Israel. He means, of course, Harris means growing isolation for Israel amongst the world community. To say such language is unusual at major U.S. Jewish organizations and is an understatement. Israel has had near carte blanche from them with negative consequences. Of course, the no-state view of the other is not peculiar to Bennett. Many Palestinians, their national movement split, still dream of all the land, the destruction of Israel, the 1948 borders, rather than compromise at the 1967 borders, or unworkable one-state options that are code for the elimination of a Jewish state. I'll have something to say when I'm done with this piece about that. Nothing would advance the just cause of Palestinian statehood faster than the irrevocable renunciation of violence by all factions and reconciliation between them on the basis of territorial compromise with Israel. But Israel must make up its mind. Netanyahu has distanced himself from Bennett, says he sets foreign policy. He, Netanyahu, sets foreign policy. The fact is, however, that Bennett has articulated the policy that exists. He is not an outlier. Harris deserves applause for his stand. American Jewish organizations must go further if Israel is ever to turn its back on the maximalist territorial temptation that it inflicts on disenfranchised Palestinians, the very exclusion that Jews lived over centuries. I'll read that again. American Jewish organizations must go further if Israel is ever to turn its back on the maximalist territorial temptation that inflicts on disenfranchised Palestinians the very exclusion which Jews lived over centuries. Mr. Cohen ends his piece, Irish Americans played a significant role in the Northern Ireland process, the Northern Ireland peace. American Jews can have similar influence on Israel-Palestine. Roger Cohen states, you can follow me on Twitter.
Yeah.
On Twitter or join me on Facebook. And a version of this op-ed appeared in print. A version appeared in print June 21st, 2013, in the International Herald Tribune. So it's not just the sickeningly liberal, quote-unquote, New York Times. It's the International Herald Tribune. For all I know, they're sickeningly liberal, too. That on June 21st, the day after this appeared on the Times Internet service. Alrighty, I said I was going to have some comments. I'm personally so happy for John Kerry. I think he's very comfortable and happy, encouraged in his new position, appointed to him by President Obama, Secretary of State of the U.S. And I think he's being very brave in speaking directly to the AJC. with words that the AJC is not used to hearing from anyone, certainly not at the podium. As Mr. Cohen said in this paragraph, many Palestinians, their national movement split, still dream of all the land, the destruction of Israel, the 1948 borders rather than compromise at the 1967 borders, or unworkable one-state options that are code for the elimination of a Jewish state. Folks, let's be clear about one thing as we are well into the 21st century now. And the, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 65th year of the existence of Israel, no peace and no security and no rights, political or otherwise, for the Palestinians. This far into the process, let's be clear about something. The notion of destroying Israel which is a very crude way of putting it, especially nowadays, is being translated into a new democratic state replacing the implicitly racist and theocratic notion of an all-Jewish state. Palestinians, in reality, despite what some of the laws on the books say, and even according to what some of the laws on the books say there, do not live in parity with the Israelis. There are many examples of this. I read some of them last Saturday, but I'll skip that for now. If you want a better idea of what those specifics are, call me at 831-427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. We are live here on June 24th, 2013. It's a minute before 4 p.m. Free Radio Santa Cruz. Again, this business about the destruction of Israel, which from even the beginnings of the PLO in 1965, the details of which were argued amongst themselves. Do we mean the physical obliteration of the state of Israel, or are we talking about a political elimination of the theocratic Jewish state? Well, it's coming to the forefront now more and more that Palestinians, both in the territories and in Israel itself, want a truly democratic state. And make no secret of their desire to see an end to the old Zionist dream of some 150 years ago. More formally, of about 120 years ago. Is that such a terrible thing? Mr. Cohen, in his article here, points out that Palestinians, even with their national movement split, which is to the delight of the Israelis, it's a divide and conquer kind of mentality where Israel knows if it can make life for the common Palestinian impossible or very difficult, it can also mess up the grassroots politics of the Palestinians. Therefore, we have the Palestinian national movement in tatters. Cohen says they, the Arabs, still dream of all the land. Well, this is entirely true of the Israeli Jews. They want all the land, as I said, according to a plan that they put forth, so that a Zionist delegation put forth In the post-World War I, 1919, the year 1919, peace treaty in Paris, which led to the formation of the League of Nations, which eventually failed. The League of Nations did. The Zionist delegation called for a predominantly Jewish state encompassing all of the Palestine that was referred to as the Mandate of Palestine under the British occupation forces after World War One, the victors, one of the victors in the First World War. All of that, a substantial amount of land east of the River Jordan, which now lies in the present Kingdom of Jordan, independent country, a portion of southern Lebanon, a portion of Syria, southwestern Syria, larger than the Golan Heights, which Israel still holds on to anyway, to the very gates of Damascus, as it were, and about 60% of the Sinai Peninsula. The Zionists in 1919 said that's what they wanted, and they set things in motion and have most of this territory, or about half of that suggestion to the world community that they asked for, suggestion that they made in 1919. So we have a theocratic Jewish state which occupies all this land, 78% of the Mandate of Palestine, not including Transjordan, more than three quarters of it. And yet, to our dismay, we still hear clauses like the Palestinians, or many Palestinians, still dream of all the land. It is the Israelis who have taken the land, never purchasing more than 5% of Palestinian land, as the earliest Zionist settlers did. The rest of it was taken by force of arms. That is a true historical fact. Mr. Cohen uses the clause, the destruction of Israel and the elimination of a Jewish state. We'll take a close look at the wordings of those. Destruction of Israel, again, is transmogrifying into a redefinition of what it is to be Israeli, of what it is to be Palestinian, and what it is to be free under a democratic system with equal rights for all and security enjoyed by everyone. Can we just eliminate the destruction, the word destruction, or the idea of destroying Israel? The purpose of that wording is always to horrify American opinion into despising Palestinian Arabs as a vulgar, violent, inherently hostile people who want to kill all the Jews. That's why we keep seeing the word destruction and destroy Israel over and over again. It's a kind of code in itself. Or as Cohen says, an unworkable one-state options that are code for the elimination of a Jewish state. Eliminating what Cohen is referring to, whether he fully appreciates it or not, is the elimination of a Jewish theocracy, which demands a minimum of 70% of the population be Jewish in order for their version of Israel to remain viable and legitimate. And instead of, that's another word that's kind of nasty to say, the elimination of a state, elimination of a Jewish state. Let's get rid of all the bad stuff and replace it with parity and true democracy. That is the only course for peace. And that ultimately is what is going to eliminate the need or the desire and the implementation of terrorism. Okay. Okay, folks, now the fun part. Comments from internet readers. As of yesterday, there had been 291 comments on this New York Times site. The first one is very contentious as I read it. Listen closely. These are not my words. They are the words of J.M. of California. Whether J.M. is the writer's true initials or not, it is the moniker this person uses for his comment. J.M. of California. While I applaud Cohen, Harris, and others for their peace-minded instincts, I think it's helpful to add the following. And he adds 5 points. One, our aid to Israel is 100% military and a tiny fraction of their economy. It is a gift to the arms industry. And he's mostly referring here to the U.S. arms industry, who are by far the largest recipient of this, quote, aid. So we have someone who is friendly to Israel, this J.M., of California, who attempts to take attention off of the fact that the greatest amount of U.S. taxpayer dollars in the form of American foreign aid goes to Israel, more to Israel than to any other country. And he is playing with figures here. Goes to the military only. And a tiny fraction of their economy. I don't see why that's a good thing. A gift to the arms industry, who are by far the largest recipients of this so-called aid. He's turning it back on the U.S. and effectively accusing the U.S. government of doing this for our own selfish economic needs, to support our own economy. Two, Israel has been the more reasonable negotiation partner for decades, but talks always fell apart because extremists on the Palestinian side started at a different starting position than the Israelis did. Now that balance is shifting. The Palestinians, this is me talking now, this is Ren talking, are so often portrayed as, oh, shall we say, Indian giving, making one statement and then pulling away from that. Just like the Israeli Navy, which accepts a brokered ceasefire by accepting a doubled limit on the fishing zone for Gazans and then arbitrarily a few months later pulling back to the original 3-mile limit. Israel has done plenty of its own changing of its mind and changing the terms of contracts and agreements, and even in terms of peace with the Palestinians. I don't think this can be blamed entirely on Palestinian extremists that are led to extreme measures and frames of mind because of the often intransigent positions that the Israelis take. This person continues, three, Naftali Bennett represents a future era when Palestinians are going to pine for Sharon and Netanyahu. This is by design. The Palestinians don't recognize today as the best opportunity to get what they want, then their wish list will have to get shorter and shorter. Now, this is something I've heard over many years, the course of many years, that the Palestinians are unreasonable and keep asking for more than they deserve or more than they can reasonably, quote-unquote, reasonably get, whereas it's the Palestinians who have done really all of the losing. They're the ones who keep losing territory, losing their numbers. Far more Palestinian Arabs have died at the hands of Israelis since 1948 than the other way around. Complaining about Palestinians being crybabies is a total diversion of reality. Number four, as much as the majority of the Israeli leadership seems to be on board with this stratagem, It's true that U.S. Jews will generally push for peace. I tend to see that as a good thing, a plausible counterbalance to the settler lobby. Eventually, it will be in Israel's interest to strike a peace deal. I have no argument with that. And JM's point number five. As Jeffrey Goldberg presciently described in a piece about a year ago, time is on the Palestinians' side, too. They can let settlers take over and then dash Israel's long-term survival by simply saying they've given up on statehood and instead want full citizen rights as Israelis. The Haredim's birth rates, notwithstanding, the demographic balance could change quickly and Israel would be no longer. Again, JM ends his point number five here with another foreboding phrase, and therefore Israel would be no longer. Well, he is referring to the original Zionist dream of an all-Jewish state would be no longer. And I say, hey, folks, it's just as well. No more pining for a single country in this whole world of over 250 countries to be all-Jewish at the cost of the indigenous Arabs, at the cost of people who lived there first. Is it worth it? And is it viable? Is it even a conscientious thing for there to be an all-Jewish state, which has to be imposed on the region, rather than one that evolved through the ages, through the centuries anyway, more naturally? Can you create a successful Jewish theocracy through military might and lobbyists in Washington and various American Jewish organizations / lovers of Israel who intimidate legislatures and play the guilt card against Americans who did nothing to stop the Holocaust? Tell me, call me. Yeah, he mentions the Haredim. I don't know exactly who he was referring to. The Haredim probably refers to the Orthodox Jews or some Orthodox population within Israel and the birth rates of them. They're certainly growing among the Palestinians. And we'll hear a lot about that, as we have recently, about how the demographic balance will change, which, according to the Israelis, would be the death knell for Israel, with a majority of Palestinians becoming taking control of Israel. And with that not being a reasonable alternative to the current situation of Israel controlling everything. Okay, we'll go on with more comments here. That was a rough one to start with, but it was the first one on the list. I don't want to be accused of leaving anyone out. Although, I admit, I did leave out the very short one or two sentences, which are of general yay or nay quality of Roger Cohen's op-ed. You know, just because they're kind of fluff, that would fill our time a little too much. Ken of Sag Harbor in Sag Harbor, New York. I always thought Sag Harbor was in Michigan, but it says Sag Harbor, New York. I'm thinking of some other place. I am an Arabic-speaking American of Jewish background, but not Jewish, who has worked extensively in the region, including in Palestine. The time has come for those of us who care about both peoples to prepare for a one-state solution. Despite the goodwill of such valiant groups as J Street, the time has likely passed for a two-state solution, given the settlements and the political makeup of Israel. The future we must now begin to envision and support is one state with no state religion or legally dominant ethnic group. Given that non-Jews are about half the population of Greater Israel, of course, referring to Israel proper in the West Bank, Gaza, Golan Heights, and East Jerusalem, anything other than a state with equal rights for all would be untenable. It could be a home for the Jewish people and Hebrew culture, but it could not be a, quote, Jewish state in the legal sense with such a huge non-Jewish population. Knowing both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs, I am confident that given time, they could live together in one state with equal rights. But the crazies must be sidelined. The hardest part, Ken says. We must envision a new future with a new paradigm and work towards it. We must all agree that the enemy is discrimination against religious and ethnic minorities, whether in Israel or Iraq or Pakistan. I know this is not an easy path, but it may be the only path. And this comment has received recommendations from 51, whereas the first one I read, mostly in support of current Israeli policy, has only 17 recommended. Instead of a thumbs up or down, New York Times runs it by just allowing people to make recommendations. 51 in the piece I just read, whereas 17 recommended the first piece. Well, Ken, as he says here, the future we must now begin to envision and support is one state with no state religion or legally dominant ethnic group. Given that non-Jews are about half the population of Greater Israel, anything other than a state with equal rights for all would be untenable. Isn't that what I've been saying up until now? David Willinger of New York, New York. The city so nice, they named it twice. I'd like to commend David Harris. It is refreshing when a Jewish leader actually speaks for Jews such as myself and not act as Netanyahu apologists. The bulk of American Jews are, quote, represented by spokesmen who speak loudly, but do they really represent the majority of us? Who elected them anyway? I vote for Mr. Harris and any other Jewish leader who's ready to pressure Israel into a two-state solution. It could be a game changer. 41 recommendations. Shoshana in Oregon. Shoshana, by the way, is the Hebrew word for rose. Shoshana says, actually she starts with a quotation here from Cohen's op-ed. Many Palestinians that are national movement split still dream of all the land, the destruction of Israel, the 1948 borders, rather than compromise at the 67 borders. End quote. Shoshana says in follow-up, that is the most important statement in the article. I don't see how Israel can ever negotiate for peace with Palestinians who will never be happy with a compromise. The U.S. never gave Texas back to Mexico. The U.S. never gave New England back to the British. Why is it that Israel is expected to give back land that was won in past wars? Why don't the countries surrounding Israel help the Palestinians? They like to criticize Israel, but they don't offer land or opportunities to Palestinians. That's not true, by the way. Many political refugees over the years have come to America, and we welcome them. Why can't Middle Eastern countries step up to the plate and welcome Palestinians to their lands? The Palestinians are pawns in a terrible game of hope and despair. Let's stop blaming only Israel. There's lots of blame to go around. Just a touch of conciliation there on the part of Shoshana. Okay, she's dealing with a number of highly overplayed and overrated and somewhat mythical statements. She out of Cohen's whole op-ed, she grabs the one that contains, as I said earlier, most of these foreboding opinions that Jews have about the Palestinians. They still dream of all the land, the destruction of Israel, the 48 borders, rather than compromise the 67 borders. Shoshana adheres to that piece. She's most attracted to that sentence without acknowledging the kinds of things that I had to say earlier about that clause in the op-ed. She says it's the most important statement in the article. Israel can never negotiate for peace with Palestinians, who will never be happy with a compromise. Israel has not exactly been compromising. Look at the status quo for them. Look at their what's the other Latin term? Modus operandi. They have always wanted it all and have succeeded in taking virtually all of it. Slowly making the Palestinians outside of Israel go away. Or reducing them to total indignation so they won't resist. U.S. never gave Texas back to Mexico. True. The U.S. never gave New England back to the British. I don't know that one was ever a particularly historical contest there. Why is it that Israel is expected to give back land that it has won in past wars? First of all, she's taking the position of the conquistador. Hey, we won wars, whether we should have started them or not, whether they should have been waged or not. Therefore, we're entitled to land. And it is almost, it's always almost been Israel that has started the wars. 1948, Israel came into existence. And the very next day, five surrounding Arab nations attacked Israel. Those Arab nations stated at the time, we are incurring into the Arab state area of the United Nations partition to restore order. That's what some of them, anyway, said. And they only did so, the day after Israel declared independence and officially became a state, according to the history books. What they're not telling you is that for 6 months before that, there was a terrible civil war of sorts going on in Palestine, waged by very well-armed, well-trained, and highly motivated Zionist partisans. Jewish Zionist partisans who wanted to establish an all-Jewish state. 6 months before the Arabs finally counterattacked. Sometimes I wonder why the Arabs didn't do something earlier. They had 6 months to sit around and think about it. That's the only thing I could conceivably hold against the Arabs. In fact, the Israeli partisans were so well-armed and had been built up over a period of at least 3 years with weapons that had been smuggled into Palestine against the rule of the British, who were trying to treat arm importations as contraband. It sounds terrible when they keep saying 5, 6, 7 Arab nations invaded Israel. What they're not telling you is the combined forces of these Arab countries were outnumbered by the Israeli partisans. This is true historical fact. It's documented. The Israeli military and intelligence archives even point this out. The Israelis outnumbered the Arabs. The partisans outnumbered the armies. That was 48. 1956. President of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, was feeling his oats, decided to throw out the British and French corporate owners and controllers of the Suez Canal and nationalize the canal. France and Britain responded in a kind of knee-jerk reaction, went into a trilateral alliance with Israel, and took the canal back. Israel's job was to charge west across the border, across all of the Sinai Peninsula, which they did in fact capture, until they were forced to give it back to Egypt. All the way to the Suez Canal, while the British and the French parachuted into the canal zone itself and retook the canal. At this point in time, we can look back and say, hey, this is a resource of the Egyptian government, of the Egyptian people. It's just as well that Nasser did what he did. But again, it was the Israelis who did the attacking. 1967, the Arabs were waving, rattling their sabers and mad at Israel, having largely to do with water rights that Israel was usurping of the surrounding Arab countries of Jordan and Syria. So the Arabs, in typical Middle Eastern fashion, made waves with their armed forces and loaded them up on the border with Israel. It ended up backfiring. Yes, it's true, Egypt moved its forces to the far end of the Sinai Peninsula, bordering Israel. Other Arab countries such as Jordan and Syria made similar moves. Israel attacked first. The infamous and oh-so-popular preemptive strike in 1967, which, according to their own original plan, the Israelis' own original plan, did not require taking the entirety of the Sinai. It didn't require taking all of the land up to the Jordan River and bordering Jordan. Didn't require the taking of the Golan Heights. But all of those things occurred. And again, Sinai was in Israeli hands. In 1967, it was only returned in the early 80s back to Anwar Sadat's Egypt. They still have the Golan Heights. They still have control of the West Bank of the Jordan. And as I read earlier from another piece, capture of all those territories, Palestinian territories and part of Syria, by the Israelis was an action which stirred Jewish religious Zionist feelings, encouraged them, and basically was the fulfillment of most of the original Zionist dream. Military conquest. And this woman here, this Shoshana, I suspect a woman, is saying, why is it that Israel is expected to give back land that was won in past wars? As though wars are always a good thing. As though wars are never perpetrated by invaders, by conquistadors. Another reason, I have another answer for her too. Israel should give back land to many people who are still alive. How many Texans who lived in Texas when it went to war with Mexico and eventually was incorporated into the United States, how many of those Texans are alive today? How many U.S. New Englanders who lived 135 years ago are alive today who experienced the American Revolutionary War? There are Palestinians and their immediate and other descendants who are still alive, hundreds of thousands of whom still live in refugee camps. I think that has something to do with why Israel should give back land. And she says, why don't the countries surrounding Israel help the Palestinians? They like to criticize Israel, but they don't offer land or opportunities to Palestinians. The population of the present-day country of Jordan, the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan, named after the ruling family there, the population of the country is 60% Palestinian. A number of refugees made it into mainstream Jordanian society, and a few have made it into more or less into mainstream Lebanese society, Egyptian, Syrian, etc. People who like to criticize Arabs for criticizing Israel because supposedly they don't help the Palestinians in the refugee camps, love to make that claim. It's all the Arab countries' fault. As though the creation of Israel had nothing to do with the creation of the generation of refugees and the foundation of refugee camps. Let's blame it all on the Arabs for using them as pawns. Hey, the Palestinians who live in the camps would love to go back to Israel. It's not their primary wish and dream of going into Lebanon and going to outlying countries. They want to return to Palestine, period. Okay. Eileen from Poplar, Montana says, in response to Roger Cohen's op-ed, "I'm surprised that there was no mention of J Street, a Jewish organization dedicated to a two-state solution and humanitarian treatment of Palestinians. It isn't restricted to Jews. I'd recommend everyone check out their website." And then she says, "This Israel uber alles attitude has got to stop." This is a play on the phrase Deutschland über alles, which was a statement from Hitler and Hitler's Nazi regime. Deutschland über alles, Germany first, Germany over all. She simply replaced the country, Israel über alles. And that sounds terrible to a lot of Jews, but I got news for you. How different is it? How unlike the Nazi dictate is it to say Israel über alles? Regarding J Street, they are a relatively leftist expression of Zionism, but they're still Zionist. J Street supports a Zionist Israel, and in my opinion, a bit of push and pull within that organization. On the one hand, support a two-state solution and proper treatment of Palestinian Arabs, but at the same time, they want to maintain a Zionist Israel. I think they're going to continue to be at odds with one another within that group. J Street. I do commend J Street, though, overall. Bill from Terrace, British Columbia. Unfortunately, U.S. And British Columbia, of course, is in Canada. Bill says, "Unfortunately, United States Jewish organizations have too often supported the settlers and BB's hardline positions." BB is the nickname for Benjamin Netanyahu, Israel's prime minister. "Too often supported the settlers and BB's hardline positions. These organizations should be pushing the U.S. to make its military aid, about one-fifth of the IDF budget, Israeli Defense Forces budget, conditional on a reversal of the settlement policy." Now, that's creative. "These settlements, all illegal under international law, and many even under Israeli law, are all heavily subsidized by the government and would disappear without those subsidies. The government simply could not support the settlements without U.S. military aid. And serious Palestinian agitation to reclaim all of Palestine would cease if the settlement policy were reversed. Palestinian terrorism, as we know it, scarcely existed before 1967 and had little or no popular support. Now Hamas has become alienated from Iran over Syria. It is the perfect opportunity to bring peace. To bring peace. It may not come again." Bill in British Columbia has a total of 38 recommendations on this thread of comments. Incidentally, Shoshana, in her mythologically oriented tirade in support of Israel and using obsolete phrases, got 52 recommendations, which in my opinion is terrible. That's one more than Ken of Sag Harbor got. Ken is the Arabic-speaking American of Jewish background, but not a Jew, who's worked extensively in the region, including Palestine. Irene, who talked about J Street, got 53. That's one more than Shoshana. You're all writing this down, folks, aren't you? Keeping close tabs on these statistics? Billenburg, Columbia got 38 recommendations. Yeah, I really like his idea of U.S. Jewish social and religious organizations stepping up to the plate themselves, being brave, and start pushing for the U.S. government to make its military aid to Israel conditional on a reversal of the settlement policy. But you won't see that happen. Legislature is too scared of AIPAC and the other pro-Israel influences in the form of lobbies in Washington. You won't see it happen. That's the way I see it now, anyway. Yes, settlements are illegal under international law and some even under Israeli law. That's the most important thing to keep in mind about all this talk about the settlements is the UN has declared, and probably the Geneva Convention people, too, have also declared that no nation may take land from another and then unilaterally start to deliver civilian populations into that area. It's not right. It's not fair. It's against international law. That's where that whole thing comes from. The settlements are heavily subsidized by the government, encouraged by the government, and the government gives logistical support to the moving and expansion and construction of them. Ezra, White Plains, New York, and this is a New York Times pick, one of their preferred focused comment people they would like people to focus on to whatever end. Ezra White Plains says, while much of what this article says may be true, the fact remains that the Palestinians do not seem ready for peace. If Abbas, that's Mahmoud Abbas, president of the Palestinian Authority, had the courage to negotiate without preconditions and to give up on the unreasonable right of return, the pressure on Israel would be enormous and would likely result in a two-state solution. The Palestinians need their Dr. King or Mandela to make this happen. But throughout their history, such leaders have been non-existent. Once they truly accept living beside a Jewish state, peace will come. Okay, to begin with, there's another phrase, which is actually a direct quote from Netanyahu himself. Palestinians do not seem ready for peace. Although Bibi comes right out and says, flat out, Palestinians are not ready for peace, even though all the aggression has been perpetrated or initiated by the Israelis. Terrorism being a reactionary kind of activity, a form of resistance, armed resistance, whether you agree with armed resistance or not. I'm not sure why a person would even say a stupid thing like Palestinians do not seem ready for peace. They live in squalor, many of them. Their economy goes nowhere. They're under heavy restriction from the military authorities in the West Bank. Hamas's Gaza is closed off from the world. I was very lucky to get in and out untainted myself 5 years ago. Very lucky. Many others who followed me in their attempts to get in were, 9 were killed, shot in the head or the back. On the last day of May 2010, the Turkish activists, 9 killed, and hundreds more were roughed up, humiliated, taken into Israeli custody against their will, and then, after varying lengths of stay, deported. I was indeed so lucky. Where was I? Yeah, Palestinians are so warlike. They get nothing, and then the world blames them, or Israel blames them, for trying to cause trouble. That makes a lot of sense. Ezra from White Plains wants the president of the Palestinian Authority, now called the State of Palestine, officially, by the way, to negotiate without preconditions, like stopping the construction and expansion of settlements. He's not asking. Abbas has never asked for all the settlements to be shut down and vacated. He just says stop growing them and stop Israeli government support of the settlements. Ezra says, no, Abbas shouldn't do that. And she claims the Palestinian right of return is unreasonable, although I'm sure she supports Israel's ongoing support of right of return of any Jew anywhere in the world to Israel. But she does make a point. If Abbas did give up on some of those positions, there would be a lot more pressure on Israel to concede and possibly result in a two-state or a one-state solution. She says Palestinians need their Dr. King and Mandela to make this happen, but she has never seen such leaders happen. You know, there was a more formal Palestinian national movement, which culminated in a revolt against the British occupiers starting in 1936 and going until sometime in 1939. The Palestinian Revolt, which of course was eventually crushed by Britain, the leaders of this nationalist movement were either killed or kind of disappeared, or they were deported from Palestine. Certainly among that group, there were some responsible leaders. They did have a revolt, and revolts are violent. But where, if any of those leaders are still alive today, wouldn't it be interesting to interview some of them? Blah, blah, blah. 54 recommendations. What a crock. Leah Olson, Berkeley, California. There are noble Dr. Kings and Mandelas within the Palestinian populace working for nonviolent solutions to the reality of two peoples belonging to one land. But they tend to get imprisoned or killed, presumably because they seek an equitable and just solution instead of merely the status quo of walls, checkpoints, home demolitions, imbalanced water rights, etc., recommended by 22. Yeah, to begin with, she is right. There are a number of nonviolent projects and experiments going on amongst the Palestinians in the West Bank and in Israel. There are even collusions of Muslims and Jews and Christians and Jews who seek a better life for everyone based on some form of reconciliation. Those activities are real and ongoing. Maybe some of them fail. I can't think of any in particular which have failed. But her claim that the Kings and Mandelas amongst the Palestinians tending to get imprisoned or killed, that does happen to some extent. But it's not only perpetrated by the Palestinians. Israel has done a lot to suppress and curtail the activities of some individuals over and over again. The same people, Dr. Omar Barghouti, Dr. Mahmoud Barghouti, I believe his first name was Mahmoud. Omar Barghouti has also been bothered and intimidated by Israel. It is Israel which holds a few thousand Palestinians, including several hundred children of legal children age, in their prisons. The great majority of them without charge, representation, or trial. It is Israel who is holding the greatest number by far of prisoners, often for not very good reasons at all. supposedly being in cahoots with the terrorists in some cases, throwing a rock at a tank. They take the child away from their family. This is part of the misery of being a Palestinian in Palestine, having your family upended and torn apart like that. Imprisoned or killed. At any rate, I think that balance is changing too. Joan Staple, Chicago, Illinois. I have a Jewish heritage, but my view of Judaism as supporting justice has been eroded by current Israeli policies. Two other points. Evangelicals are not interested in the health of the Jews. Many of them believe that Jews will either be converted or destroyed. So Israel is making a deal with the, quote, devil. She's talking about the implicit support of American Christians who claim themselves to be Zionists, but that is to their own ends. The Christians who claim to love Israel so much, really, their agenda is to have all the Jews converted to following Jesus. That's what she's saying there. So Israel is making deal with the devil. Also, when Americans like Sheldon Adelson buy, quote-unquote, Israeli policy, it skews the situation. Sheldon Adelson is an extremely rich American Jew who has given massive monetary support to the Zionists, various American Jewish organizations to support Israel. I'll never forget a quotation that I picked up from a short piece about Adelson. He was quoted at a presentation amongst American Jews, and I'll bet he has said this several times over, is that anyone who studies world history will tell you Palestinians have absolutely no claim to the Holy Land. Flat out. The people who've lived there for over a millennia. In fact, since biblical times, but are not Jews, have absolutely no claim to the land of Israel. That's what Adelson said. Regardless of Palestinian rhetoric and deeds, the Palestinian people are suffering. This situation cannot be sustained, and in the long run, the Jewish people will suffer too. 60 recommendations, the highest number yet. I agree with most of what she says. Jolie, New York City. We Americans must consider Israeli policy towards Palestinians as carefully as if it were our own. I assert that in effect it is. We pay for it with what's getting close to $3 billion annually. That's just the military aid. Everyone else seems to appreciate the fact better than most Americans do. That fact better than most Americans do. Many Americans don't understand that this is why Israel's policies are seen around the world as inseparable from our own. So we pay for it in two ways, with our money and our name. Examine it closely, always. Thanks to Roger Cohen for another informative, thoughtful column on the matter. 38 recommends. M. Delalio, Glen Cove, New York. I suggest that Israeli leaders and American Jews read the well-researched book Facts on the Ground and realize that their descriptions of the, quote, promised land do not coincide with anthropology and archaeology. 16 recommendations. Ooh, there's a degree of resistance against that man's thoughts. 16. Realist. From Arizona, another NYT pick. Roger Cohen only gets the situation half right. In my experience, after many trips to Israel and living there for a year, the majority of Israelis find the settlers a nuisance, but also cannot ignore that Land for Peace only garnered suicide bombers, the Second Intifada, and rockets, supposedly resulting from the Gaza disengagement in return. Until they feel the Palestinian leadership is willing to stop these attacks, they are content to focus on domestic issues and not worry about the settlements. Earlier on the show, Several weeks ago, I talked about how disturbing it is that Israelis are focusing on domestic issues and preferring not to even acknowledge the existence or the presence of Palestinians. And that the Israelis themselves are not worried about the settlements. They may consider them a nuisance, but I would say the Israelis, for their own security and own well-being, have to engage proactively with the problem of the settlers. And this realist is skeptical about peace with the Palestinians because he says land for peace has only resulted in suicide bombers. I think there were other factors involved there. As for rockets coming from Gaza, as I read earlier, the Israelis tightened their grip and their monitoring and regulation of their border with Gaza in the 1990s, roughly 10 years before they vacated the settlements out of the Gaza Strip. The rockets probably, Gaza had been under the gun there from Israel for so long and sometimes attacked by the IDF forces that they decided to give them some of their own. So that's why the missiles have been coming out of Gaza. Okay, people, that's all we have time for. This has been the Mideast Madness Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz. The archive of most of these radio programs, Mideast Madness, are available at radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, all, A-L-L, dot, N-E-T. Just go to radioforall.net, search for Mideast Madness, and download the program. You don't even need to sign in or log in to listen. I need to sign in and log in to keep up my archives. This show is recorded, successfully recording, so it will be available and probably refed to you, reran on this radio service over the course of the coming week. I won't have time. I don't no longer have the 5 minutes that I want to get into with you about some things that I'm personally and professionally concerned with about this particular show. So I'll do that on Saturday. Join me Saturday at 11 a.m. for more Mideast Madness, and again next Monday at 3. 4 hours a week of Mideast Madness on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, streaming live at freakradio.org. You can also communicate with me and the show directly at MideastMadness@gmx.com. G as in George, M for Michelle, X as in Lexus. Well, there's an X in there somewhere. MideastMadness@gmx.com. Talk at you later. Here is Palestine Today.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org.